I'm going to get started. My name is Lee Tiem. I'm a senior staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We're based in San Francisco, California. We've been in existence since July of 1990, and some people will say that we are the ACLU of the internet. We are actually pretty focused these days on intellectual property rights, copyright law, that sort of thing, in addition to free speech and privacy. And so what I'm going to be talking about today is the internet and intellectual property. You'll see that I have fair use in quotes here. That's because this is about a little bit more than fair use under copyright law. This is the very, very dry sort of legal background here. We're talking about these things and in copyright law, and especially the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And then when I say DRM, do people know what that means? That's a reference to digital rights management. Digital rights management is the big thing in the content world today. It's what Hollywood is after, it's what the Recording Industry Association of America is after, and it is a way of putting technology in the service of copyright owners. These are the policy issues. Who is going to control all of these things? And a lot of people don't understand it, and one of the things that we're still doing is trying to explain to people what the issues are. And someone once said, if you're explaining, you're losing. Right now, we're still sort of fighting to make sure that people get the sound bites. Right now, the sound bite out of Hollywood is piracy, 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 and everything is about that. Professor Larry Lessig is one of the great internet legal scholars today, and he has tried to make the case that this is really a war about who owns our culture. And he's given a talk about copyright, the copyright wars and the internet probably 100 times now. This little refrain that he wrote up is something that he presented at the Open Source Convention in San Francisco a couple of weeks ago. And as he puts it, if you remember this from my talk, you will have gotten the big points. This is the big picture. Now, a lot of people who are artists, musicians, writers, are understandably worried when groups like the EFF talk about the problems with copyright, because they're all creators and they're going to be looking to copyright as well to protect their business, their rights, their works. So, I like to add a caveat. We are not about wiping out copyright. When we say talk about free software, free culture, we're not talking about free as in you don't have to pay for it anymore necessarily. We're talking about free and unrestricted, that people get to create, that creativity isn't being stifled by the large corporate interests who have a particular way of looking at the world and want to sit on the internet and make sure that it can't be used to do anything that they want to do. We'll start with the history. 1790 is sort of the origin of copyright. And this is how limited copyright was back then. It just didn't do that much to stop people from borrowing from the past, borrowing from other authors, using their creativity to transform the culture that was around them. The idea was, that they had for copyright was one publisher who had paid an author in order to get a book wouldn't get ripped off by a second publisher who didn't have to pay the author and just would make copies from the copies that had already been made. I mean, that's fundamentally what copyright was about back in at the beginning of our copyright. Now, I have fair use in quotes because I think we miss the point if we focus only on fair use. Copyright's about copying, but there is so much that isn't copying. Reading a book, singing a song, a lot of these things are what copyright law regards as unregulated uses. Fair use only talks about being able to do the regulated uses without permission. So, you know, copying is definitely controlled by copyright, but we get to copy bits and pieces up to a certain amount of other works in order to use in our own work, in critical reviews, that sort of thing, in scholarship. So let's keep in mind that there are really three categories of use here, and that fair use is just a tiny, tiny bit of it. Here are some examples of things that would not be legal if copyright were purely and completely absolute. But this is very close to the way that copyright is today, except for the fact that we have fair use and some of these unregulated uses. Copying a news article, the right of reproduction. Clipping a movie frame, a right of reproduction. Reverse engineering, not just copying, but also derivative, the right to create a derivative work. Cutting out a cartoon, this is the public display right. Singing songs, that's the performance right. Even playing it on your CD player, still a performance. But what are we doing in this area to try to prevent copyright from going too far? These are a few of the cases and issue areas that we've been involved in. Some of you may have heard of the 2600 case, where we have been trying to defend Emmanuel Goldstein, the publisher of 2600 magazine, who actually published the code for a program called DCSS. The Felton case was a case where a scientist analyzed watermarks for the Secure Digital Music Initiative. This is an attempt by the recording industry to control the playing of music technologically. He and his research team figured out how to circumvent this technology, and they were threatened with a lawsuit for publishing a scientific paper at a conference that would have explained how they did it. Eventually, they were able to publish the paper because we negotiated an agreement with the recording industry to let them do it, and they presented their paper at a Usenix conference last year. The Xbox, I represented a grad student at MIT earlier this year. He's a hacker, but you know, he's at MIT, and he loves video games, and he analyzed the security system on the Xbox video game console. They use a lot of crypto in there, but he discovered that by opening up the box, that part of the bus transmitted signals in the clear to the CPU, and he was able to build a device for about $100 that duplicated what a $50,000 device used to do to get those signals out of the machine. The problem was that doing that probably violated the DMCA, and his professors knew that, and they called us, and we were able to negotiate agreement with Microsoft, whereby Microsoft agreed to let him publish the paper. Sklyarov, Elcomsoft. This is a case involving the Adobe ebook reader. I'll talk more about that later. Dmitry Sklyarov was a Russian programmer who presented a paper at DEF CON a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, talking about why the security on the Adobe ebooks was so bad. How could it be circumvented? Adobe got the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Northern District of California to charge him with violating the DMCA. Replay TV, this is a case about digital video recorders, the modern equivalent of a Betamax. There being the maker, Sonic Blue, the makers of Replay TV, which is like TiVo, are being sued by the recording industry to try to get those devices declared unlawful. We represent a bunch of owners of Replay TV who have intervened in the lawsuit. You know, a lot of times these kinds of lawsuits are fought between big companies and those of us who, at the end of the day, have a real stake in what's going on. The users, the rest of the public, just aren't represented in those lawsuits. We intervened, which meant we filed papers saying, you cannot do this case unless some of us are in there too. And just a few weeks ago, the judge said, yeah, you get to intervene, which means that consumers' rights in using devices are going to be aired in this lawsuit. Music City, they used to be called, they used to use Morpheus, the Fast Track software, which is a peer-to-peer networking software for distributed file sharing. They don't anymore, but we still represent them. And here, you know, our big issue is innovation in peer-to-peer. I'll talk a lot more about that later. The last is a really impressive set of acronyms. BPDG stands for the Broadcast Protection Discussion Group. This is a typical Hollywood industry kind of group that works behind the scenes to decide technical standards, to decide rules that will regulate devices, and then they present it as a fait accompli so that everyone in the world thinks that this is the way things have to be. SSSCA, CBDTPA, these were proposed legislation in Congress that would essentially turn whatever consensus the BPDG created into legally enforceable rights for the copyright owners. Broadcast flag is one of three components of the big plan that Hollywood has for the world, and I'll talk about that later. Let me give you a little quick background about the different kinds of IP and how they control culture. The main one that I'll be concerned about, as I said at the beginning, is copyright and the DMCA. These other things all sort of want to be trade secret and trademark. A lot of people think of them as intellectual property, but they're much more limited than that. Trespass to chattels is something that's very new, has gotten big in the last couple of years. I won't talk about it much today, but I warn you that it is one of these old doctrines. The classic law school hypo for trespass to chattels is, say, pulling someone's dog's ears, right? That's a trespass in the sense that it's a chattel, because a chattel is a form of property that's not real estate, personal property. And it's a trespass because it's an interference with the property in some sense. The way this doctrine is being used, first it's been applied to spam. People have been arguing and winning on the theory that spammers are trespassing to web servers, and more recently it's been applied to spider bots that have been crawling websites, collecting information from, you know, eBay or whatever, for doing price aggregation. You know, you have these sites that go out to all the different vendors and people, and they figure out, you know, what the price is for a, you know, iBook G3 400 megahertz, and then they can aggregate all those and say, okay, the lowest price is at blah. A lot of merchants don't want that to happen. They're using trespass chattels to stop it. Eventually, we feel that trespass chattels has the potential to make linking on the web unlawful. Now, the story you will hear, or we do hear every day from content owners, is very simple. And that's one reason why they're getting things out of Congress and out of government. Everything is theft. Anything that might be a lost copy or a lost use, they monetize it and say, look, we have lost billions of dollars because of this. I mean, it is to the point where, you know, you can find quotes from the industry saying that, when you walk out of the room during a commercial break, you're taking money out of our pockets because you're reducing the audience for the TV show, because that's what advertisers are. The only reason the TV show is there is so the advertiser can get your eyeballs. And if you walk out, well, you know, that stuff's going to dry up. But the fact is that copyrighted works have never been treated that way. They are not like a piece of land. They are not like a necklace. They are a property that has always been, former property that's always been recognized to have a real public interest. So we, in our rhetoric, which doesn't get a lot of traction yet, talk about copyright as a bargain. And, you know, from a constitutional standpoint, the basis of copyright and patent law is to promote the progress of science and the arts. And we, as I said before, you know, authors, artists are entitled to a fair return. You know, unfortunately, the way that copyright law is today, it gives them much more than a fair return, and it has taken away from consumers their unregulated and fair uses. I went over this before very quickly. These are the kinds of rights authors have: copying, adaptation, etc. There are lots of, if you ever bothered to read the copyright law, you'll see that it is extremely complex. It is kind of like the tax code, because over the years, as every new industry, every new kind of market opened up, the entrenched copyright industries, the entrenched copyright owners, fought to prevent the copyright laws from being interpreted to be protect the newcomers, and so they always had to negotiate. So you'll see that the history of copyright is a lot of carve-outs, a lot of exemptions. When radio came along, things changed. When the phonograph record came along, things changed. When TV came along, things changed, all because the first comers, the guys who were there first, were fighting tooth and nail to keep the new technologies from getting any kind of a foothold. Now, the rights we have under copyright law include all those unregulated uses that I was talking about earlier. If I buy a book, I can read it once, twice, a dozen times. The copyright owner has no legal right over my reading that book. The copyright owner has a legal right over the sale of the copy, the copying of the copy, but not over what I do with it in terms of reading. They also have no rights over facts. They have no rights over ideas. They have rights over the expression itself. The right of adaptation refers to this notion of a derivative work. Like, I take one story and I make another story using the same characters. You know, we see this a lot in fan fiction. Fan fiction raises tremendous copyright issues. It also raises tremendous trademark issues. These are, from a copyright standpoint, you know, an unauthorized Star Trek story is a serious copyright violation. Copyright is for limited times. I started out by saying back in 1790, copyright lasted 14 years. This is one of our favorite examples in talking about the copyright law. And if I were better with PowerPoint, I would have a very nice picture of Walt Disney and a very nice picture of Mickey Mouse here. You know, he created Mickey Mouse in 1928 in a short cartoon movie called Steamboat Willie. What most people don't know is that this was a parody of Buster Keaton's famous movie Steamboat Bill. This sort of appropriation from others' work is exactly the sort of thing that companies like Disney complain about today and call theft. You know, think of all those famous movies, you know, your Sleeping Beauty and Cinderella and whatever. These are all based on other people's work. Their empire is built on it. And I don't condemn that. EFF doesn't condemn that. Our point is that they're being hypocritical. They build an empire based on taking other people's works, but they don't want that to happen today. This is all creativity. It's not theft. Here's a very simple example, just one little bit of the picture that shows you how copyright has expanded massively over American legal history. I mean, the expansion from 14 years to 56 years in 1909, well, you know, that's substantial, but You know, it's nothing like what's happened since. You know, I was talking about how the various business interests keep, you know, changing the copyright law. Well, 11 times since 1962, they have, you know, made the length of the copyright term longer. Right now, there's a Supreme Court case called Eldred versus Ashcroft, which Larry Lessig, who I referred to earlier, is litigating. He represents a number of publishers who specialize in using true public domain works. You know, if you've ever heard of Project Gutenberg, you know, these people put out on the internet in simple text form all sorts of public domain works, like, say, Alice in Wonderland or whatever. But in the Eldred case refers to, is a challenge to the constitutionality of the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, which, among other things, took a whole bunch of works that had recently entered the public domain in 1998 and said, let's put these back into copyright. You know, the copyright clause of the Constitution says the limited times. And, you know, the big question is, well, how can you keep extending copyright, even on things that are in the public domain, and still say that you have copyright only for limited times? You know, the movie industry's position is that copyright can last for infinity minus a day, because that's still limited. You know, you can have anything. And then at the end of it, you can add to it again because, you know, for a while at least, it was limited. You know, we're concerned that there are going to be things that never fall into the public domain because of what Congress may do at the bidding of Hollywood. And plus, you know, and this is just the length of the copyright term. I mean, I did not want to bore you with the details, but in many, many ways, you know, if you think of copyright as a, in 1790, as this little circle, that the size of that circle has just expanded tremendously in terms of how much control copyright gives to the copyright owner. I mean, a simple example is back in 1790, there was no such control over derivative works, about adaptations of a work. Say you translated a work into a different language, you made changes, say a book into a play. You know, this was not regulated by copyright in 1790. Now, you know, you have arguably good copyright claims if someone takes a photograph and sets it and somehow translates it into music. You know, they can argue, hey, that's a derivative work. It was based on my work. This is another one of the examples I like. This filmmaker was doing this. Unfortunately, in the course of filming this classroom, we caught a couple seconds of the TV in the back of the room. Homer Simpson was visible in the editing room. Well, Matt Groening was a friend of his, and he called and said, well, you know, is this okay? And Groening says, yeah, no problem. Just call so-and-so. Unfortunately, the so-and-sos were lawyers, and they said, well, it's going to, you know, permission's going to cost you $25,000. And he's going, but it's only 2 seconds, and this is a documentary, non-profit, non-commercial, educational film. And they said, we don't care. This happens, you know, over and over in the movie industry. It's terrible for documentary people because they have to, you know, their choice is either to, you know, have the creative process cluttered by permissions after permissions after permissions, or they make these extremely sanitized movies that contain nothing of our popular culture in them. Well, you know, you may or may not like our popular culture, but it is something that grounds expression, grounds people's works in things that other people can identify with and relate to. This is the insanity in copyright today, and as I point out, we haven't even gotten to the internet issues yet. So, you know, this is the ideas, again, this is what is at stake, the ability to build on the past, and right now we are losing that. You know, we are a, as I said, a high-tech civil liberties group. So, you know, what's all this got to do with what we worry about? Well, there are three big technical changes that are within our core mission that have to do with computers and the internet. The main thing that everyone thinks about is, well, gee, you know, with the internet, it's cheap and easy to send copies all over the place. And that's true. And, you know, we understand why a lot of publishers are concerned about that. But the problem's actually a lot deeper. You know, the number two issue is that you're always copying when you use computers. Everything is a copy. This is a completely different, this is a paradigm shift from when moving around physical copies, because when you buy a book at the bookstore, you don't automatically get it by making a copy. But if you download a file from something using your web browser or whatever, you're making a copy. In fact, you probably make several copies. You're copying in RAM, there may be a cache, whatever. You can't even read something without a copy in some sense being made. Plus, you know, you were creating an additional display on your screen, which, you know, is arguably implicates the display right. So what that does is change this whole sort of categorization we had of unregulated uses and regulated uses and then fair use, because everything's a regulated use from the get-go. The third change is what I like to call device dependence. Again, you know, I don't need anything special to read this piece of paper. But if I have a file, an electronic file, I have to have something in order to even have it be perceptible. And as we know, you can build control of the document, you can build control of a user experience into the technology, into the device. IP owners have always known this. I think probably the first case that touched on this was player pianos and player piano rolls. Later with the display of movies at theaters, they wanted to control the devices, movie projectors. Back then, the Supreme Court said, wait a minute, you know, yeah, you can, you know, you have control over your works, but we're not going to let you extend that market power into the movie projection industry. The courts tried to keep separate, you know, the copyright owners in content and everybody else in playing devices. And that is a way, sort of a separation of power, sort of a checks and balances, the same way that Congress can pass a law, but it takes a president to sign it to make it actually mean something. The idea we have is that, you know, the content owners and the player manufacturers, whether they're hardware or software, can check each other. It's not going to be one controlling the other. Obviously, this has implications for reverse engineering and the ability to tinker. So, you know, I've already made all these points one way or another during the talk so far. Digital rights management messes with the copyright bargain. And it messes with it in the way that even though the law says this is still a fair use, this is an unregulated use, the technology says, no, you can't do it. It won't let you. And the fact that the law says you can doesn't mean that in reality you can. And as a lot of people are fond of saying, if you can't exercise your rights, you don't have them. And then along with the other problems, and then there are the other problems. IP is a tool of censorship. I'll be talking more about free speech issues tomorrow. There is harm to competition. There's harm to innovation. I'll spend the next few slides talking about the VCR case, Betamax. This was when the movie industry sued Sony, saying, wait a minute, people use your VCR to make copies. You're helping all of those people out there make copies. You should be liable for indirect copyright infringement. And that means we should be able to enjoin the sale of VCRs. This is just some legal babble here. There are two types of infringement, direct and indirect. You cannot sue someone for indirect infringement unless you can show a direct infringement. So in the VCR case, the direct infringement would be if I make a bunch of copies of a copyrighted TV show, then there's a direct infringement, and then you can predicate an indirect infringement action against the VCR manufacturer on the basis of the of my direct infringement. And there are two types, contributory and vicarious. The difference used to be a lot more important than it is now. The courts really don't seem to care. They have very much bought in to the copyright owner's rhetoric. So if you can show that the technology is being used by others to commit infringement, then you know you're going to have a big problem. So the Betamax question raised this issue of what I call device dependence. What kind of a world are we going to have? Are we going to have a world in which all devices are automatically suspect and as pirate devices simply because they could be used to commit direct copyright infringement? Well, the Supreme Court said in 1984 a few things. What most people remember is that time shifting is fair use. That if I make a copy of a TV show and then later watch it, that's actually a fair use under copyright law. But the most important part for our purposes is that the Supreme Court also articulated a doctrine regarding devices. And it said that if you have something like a VCR, which is they called a staple item of commerce, and it could be used for infringement, it cannot be blocked for indirect infringement so long as it's capable of substantial non-infringing uses. And since the Supreme Court had decided that time shifting was indeed fair use, therefore the Betamax was capable of substantial non-infringing uses. There was evidence that showed that a large number of people did just that. There was also very important in this case that there was I don't know how many of you guys remember Mr. Rogers, but this was a guy who had this great show on PBS for kids, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And back in, you know, the early 80s, you know, people really listened to him. And he submitted a declaration in the Betamax case on behalf of Sony saying that he thought it was great that parents were able to make copies of his TV show so that they could show it to their kids later when they came home from school, because there are a lot of places where it might be showing during a school time. And he didn't mind that they would play it over again, that they would keep it. And this, you know, was just one particular declaration that attempted to rebut what the industry was saying. But according to everything I've read, it had a big impact. It got the justices to see that, well, you know, this copying thing isn't really all that bad. You know, there can be some value to it. And this was a 5-4 decision, so, you know, you take what you can get. Well, what our point about the Betamax case is this principle defines the border between copyright control, culture control, and innovation. It's why we're able to have all sorts of devices that do copy, even though Hollywood and the recording industry doesn't like it. And, you know, you can't control every technology just because it might be used for infringement. But that's the past. That's why I called the Betamax case the last great case of the classical copyright era. Copyright owners they're not idiots, and they have a lot of money. They saw their business model falling apart, or they thought that it would fall apart, and they started to act. And the way they acted was to go to Congress. In the last 10 years, if you are a copyright law scholar, you will see that there have been many very sweeping changes in copyright law. The Audio Home Recording Act, the AHRA, it put a tax on CD media and required the use of something called the Serial Copy Management System. This was a plan that was attempted to fight against serial copying, that is, making copies from copies. They would allow you to make one copy from your original, but you couldn't keep going. This was probably the first time that copyright law had been used to really directly control a technology. And, you know, this was a compromise. I think the big thing, as I recall, the digital audio tape was the big reason why they were so concerned, because all of a sudden you had digital copies. You know, analog cassettes, well, yeah, you can make serial copies, but they degrade. But with DAT, they were very, very concerned. 1995, DPRSR attempted to adapt to the internet some more, created this notion of a digital phono record and digital phono record delivery. This is a minor sort of copyright technical point that anything that's not music, we call it a copy. But if you make a copy of something that's that's music or sound, then it's not a copy. It's actually a phono record. So the DPRSR, you know, was for digital phono records. 1997, we call this NETA. It created a new form of criminal copyright infringement. Traditionally, I mean, over 200 years, you could not have criminal copyright infringement liability absent a commercial purpose or motive. If you were doing it for personal reasons, non-commercial reasons, then there would not be, you could not be criminally prosecuted. NETA changed that. 1998, the CTAA, I've already talked about that. The 1998 DMCA, Digital Millennium Copyright. I'm going to talk about that a little more, but because it is one of the linchpins of the modern digital rights management movement. And now we have the acronyms that I mentioned before, which would attempt to force a lot of mandates down technical device manufacturers' throats. Digital rights management. This is, you know, this is serves the content owner's rhetoric. Everything that's not paid for it, that we don't allow you to do, is theft. The ideas are pretty simple. There are technical people in this audience who would explain them much better than I. But very simply, you can do things like encrypt a work, and you can do things like add watermarks to it that cannot easily be removed. So that if you watermark something, just like with paper, it authenticates it. It will, every time you copy it, the watermark persists, so they'll always be able to know what you made a copy from. Crypto prevents you from getting into the work unless you get a password or key that they have sold to you. Now, the way DRM, the key point about DRM is that the devices have to obey or comply with these rules. Now, where I have been most familiar with and worked the most with DRM is in the area of music recording. I had mentioned the Felton case, which involved the Secure Digital Music Initiative's technologies for music and digital music control. Among the things that they wanted to do was to set up actually a very interesting system of watermarks, both robust and fragile watermarks. And they could combine, create combinations of watermarks in digital music files so that some watermarks would stay no matter when you copied them, and others would be destroyed, the fragile ones. So this way they could detect both whether or not a particular piece of music that they had, a particular MP3 file was an original or had been copied, and they could also always identify it as one of theirs. My guys, my research team was able to both destroy the robust watermarks and was able to recreate the fragile watermarks. So you can imagine if you had a system where it was making decisions based on whether or not you had a copy or an original, but I could hack the computer so that I could always put the fragile watermark back, then it would always think that this had not been copied, right? That's just one sort of simple example of how you can defeat these sorts of systems. Or, you know, watermark. Maybe it couldn't read the watermark. I mean, suppose if we're putting out digital music files right now with these watermarks, the ordinary CD player that isn't watermark aware doesn't recognize them in the first place and isn't going to make any kind of decisions about it. So you have to have something in the player, playing device, the receiving device, that actually understands what the watermark's trying to say. So this is what I mean about saying devices have to obey these commands. And this requires a significant degree of cooperation from device manufacturers. And it also means that the rest of us can't be allowed to tinker with it. So this in a nutshell is how DRM upsets the copyright bargain. You know, we're supposed to be able to use works without permission. But DRM allows the building of digital locks or fences, which TPM stands for Technical Protection Measures, which is the legal jargon in the DMCA. And the DMCA has rules against circumvention. Two kinds of circumvention. One, the act of circumventing an access protection is forbidden. So let's say I buy a DVD. The DVD is access protected with some kind of crypto. I can't break into that without violating the law. Now, the way that the current DVD system works is all the commercial players out there have a technology for unscrambling their encryption. So they use something called CSS, Content Scrambling System. And all the DVD players out there understand CSS, and they know how to get around it. So they are authorized compliant devices. Well, let's suppose I buy one of these CSS-protected DVDs. You know, one would think that if I buy that, just as if I buy a book, I have bought the right to read it. If I buy a CSS-protected DVD, have I not bought the right to watch it? I mean, why else did I buy it? But it turns out that they're very concerned about things like, can you play it on a Linux player, other kinds of technologies. So the way the law is right now, if you have a Linux DVD player, but CSS doesn't support Linux, you can't play it on your Linux computer. And, you know, our position is, well, you know, if you've already lawfully bought the damn thing, and the only reason you're doing something is so that you can play it on another machine of yours, which doesn't actually hurt the copyright content owner's rights in any way, why should the law prevent you from doing that? But that's what the DMCA does. And it also says not only can you not do the act of circumventing the access control in order to do something that you are lawfully entitled to do, it says you also can't create a technology for doing it. The DCSS was this technology. It was a technology that would allow people, among other things, to play DVDs on unauthorized players. And we lost that case. And the Southern District of New York and the Second Circuit Court of Appeals said, no, you cannot, you know, it's unlawful for him to create DCSS and it may not be distributed. So this gives content owners a tremendous ability to use technology to lock up works. So these are some of the things that you can't do or you won't be able to do in a DRM-compliant future. Now, this may seem like somewhat of an exaggeration, but it's not. Here's an example. The e-books, Now, this is another case we're involved in. The Adobe eBook Reader software is a platform for enforcing publishers' preferences about copying and other things. We got involved in this case when the programmer Sklyarov was charged with violating the DMCA, and he was put into jail and held there for several weeks without bail. He worked for a company called Elcomsoft that made a program that effectively circumvents the protections of the Adobe eBook Reader. You know, the second two bullet points are examples of what an eBook, what the eBook Reader software allows the publisher to do. You know, both of these books are public domain books, but you know, if you buy the eBook of Aristotle's Politics, you cannot make any copies. You cannot print any of it to paper. That's because the technology prevents you from doing it. Even though there's nothing in the law that says that that they should be able to do that. I mean, they don't even own it. Well, so the AEBPR is the name of, was the name of Elcomsoft's program. And what it would do would be to liberate these locked up ebooks from Adobe's from the joint Adobe publisher control. Now, Adobe always said, "Well, we don't control anything. We just make it possible for the author, for the publishers to do it." You know, this is one of the common sorts of pieces of vendor rhetoric. We create an infrastructure. We're not responsible for what people do with the infrastructure. We're not particularly impressed with that argument. The Elcomsoft software lets you, it basically turns this crippled PDF into a real PDF. And so you can use, you know, Ghostwriter or whatever, various other kinds of third-party PDF readers as well. You can put them on other machines. You can use them with unsupported OSs, etc. And it was actually designed so that it would only work on lawfully purchased ebooks. Because when you bought the ebook, you also bought a key, and there was a transaction, and there was a some sort of electronic voucher, I think they called it, and the Adobe and the Elcomsoft program required the use of this additional piece of information in order to run. If you didn't have it, you wouldn't be able to use AEBPR in order to change the settings on the ebook. Yeah, this case is going to trial sometime later this year, the good thing about it is that they ended up making a deal where they're not really going after Dmitry, the programmer anymore. They're going after the company, which is the right defendant, because all he did was talk about the software. He helped work on it, but he wasn't responsible for making any kind of business decisions about whether or not to sell this program. And this is what's also interesting. It's a Russian company, and in Russia, the copyright law actually permits AEBPR to be used in precisely this fashion, because under Russian law you have an affirmative legal right, a positive right to make backups of things. We don't have, you know, this is one of the issues we have here with American copyright law, is that all of these things that I've been talking about, the unregulated uses, the fair uses, they're the leftovers. The way that the copyright law works is it assigns these positive rights to the copyright owners and then leaves alone all these other things. But it doesn't say that you absolutely have the affirmative right to do it. It means it's simply more like saying they're not allowed to sue you if you do. Well, the difference then is that if they can make it impossible for you to do that without using the law, you have no, direct recourse. Another case that we're working on right now, this is the Replay TV case. I talked about it earlier. It's another form of the Betamax argument today. Now, you know, people will argue about, well, maybe automatic commercial skipping is different from from fast-forwarding through commercials. I mean, I suppose it is, but I don't think it's enough of a difference to warrant saying, okay, we can enjoin the use of this and make you completely do exactly what we want to do. Sort of the big story here, innovation and competition. This is an economic argument. You know, basically, you know, anyone who thinks in antitrust terms realizes that Hollywood and the RIA have great market power. If I am Philips, if I am Matsushita, if I am Zenith, I am not interested in making a device that can't play Hollywood's movies because my market will be very, very small. So what they have done is they have essentially created a cartel that says we're all going to use the same technical system to protect this, our works, and that means that if you want to make a player that's able to play our works, you have to get a license from us. And this is backed up by the DMCA, because in the old days, what an enterprising small business might have done is like, well, you've got CSS, but I know how to build a machine that will crack it, and I can sell that. And now think this through carefully. You know, so if one of you lawfully acquires this DVD that's been encrypted with CSS, you haven't done anything wrong, okay? Right? I mean, you bought this movie. In the old days, I would be able to make a DVD player that gets around their CSS, and you would be able to watch that movie on my DVD player. I don't think anyone's done anything wrong here. You know, you're getting to play it on a different machine. But it's not a machine that Hollywood controls. And so under the DMCA, though, I can't do that, because the machine that has its version of DCS in it and can unlock the DVD is violating the right that they got under the DMCA to have an enforceable digital lock. And so because of the DMCA, anyone who wants to make a DVD player that plays a Hollywood DVD must get a license, must enter into a contract with the Hollywood movie studios. And so they can, in that contract, in that license agreement, bind the technology makers to pretty much whatever they want, because without that license, they can't sell this thing. And that means they can put in all sorts of conditions that have nothing to do with piracy. There is, in the current version of the DVD licensing agreement, provisions for region coding. So that means that if you buy a DVD in... the world is divided geographically into, I think, 5 regions. We're region 1. I think region 2 is Europe. I think region 3 is Asia. A region 1 DVD... plays only in DVDs that are DVD players that are authorized to play region 1. So if you buy a region 2 DVD player and you have a region 1 DVD player, you won't be able to play it. Now there are some DVD players that have been authorized to play multiple regions, and there are different sorts of things that they're doing, but what they can do is they can control the market. They have territorially divided up the market this way. There's also a no fast forward flag, so that you cannot, if they want, they can say you can't fast forward through the stuff at the beginning. So if they threw in trailers for their new movie at the beginning, they could code it so that that cannot be skipped. So the DMCA keeps technology in line and does all these other bad things that I apparently have no time to talk about. And since I've taken so long, I will stop. I will end with my last two slides here. There is a big battle over P2P, peer-to-peer networks. It's again the same theme. Okay. we are defending a company called Music City. And it raises, it's the question again of, is a technology maker responsible for what its users do? Now, a lot of people say, why isn't this like Napster? Because Music City uses the Morpheus, Kazaa, it uses a Nutella version of Nutella now, Kazaa, Fastrack, all that sort of stuff, which is a much more decentralized system than Napster ever was. You know, this is, it's not a pure music service because it is open to print text content, video, all sorts of things. It is truly decentralized. And when we got into this suit, you could take down Music City servers completely. The only thing that Music City did was it provided the client that you use on your machine, and then it served you ads. That was its business model. But, you know, you could nuke Music City's servers, its ad servers, and every user would still be able to exchange files with other users on the system. There was no control. So this is another version of the Betamax problem. And so I'm going to, you know, start to wrap up here. You know, is Netscape responsible for any copyright infringements you do using the browser? Is Microsoft responsible for copyright infringements you do using its word processing program? You know, I don't think so. Let's imagine a world where Hollywood has the power to design the technologies we want to use on the internet and on our computers, if it can veto those technologies. I don't think we would have a lot of what we have today. Now, we do not have a solution to the question of how artists, authors should fairly be compensated. We understand that a lot of these technologies do create a risk of unauthorized infringements. And, you know, we don't have an answer to that. But we're very sure that the answer is not to say that Hollywood and the recording industry get to decide how our software, how our computers are going to be architected. The broadcast flag, I will put this very quickly. This is because of HDTV. Congress really wants HDTV out there because it's going to make money for them. Problem is that Hollywood says we're not going to put any feature movies on digital broadcast unless there's some sort of scheme whereby we can be assured there won't be any privacy. So what do they want? They want something called this broadcast flag. The broadcast flag would be a bit that says do not copy. Well, that's not going to work unless every machine, every device that's capable of receiving that broadcast signal or getting that broadcast signal obeys the bit. That's what this is about. They want to have a law that says you have to obey the bit, and that means that they are going to essentially have the FCC or Congress or somebody put control of all internet hardware and software in the service of the copyright industry. Back to the refrain. This is again just the same points over and over again. They are doing this to using copyright to do this to creativity and innovation. And you know, we need your help. We have been fighting this war for several years now. We have been at the on the front lines, ahead of all the other civil liberties groups, ahead of the engineers, ahead of companies like Intel. The big companies are very scared of Hollywood. They don't want to fight this fight. They don't agree with Hollywood, but if they can get Hollywood off their backs, they will do it. And they will do it without regard to what consumers want. And it's our mission right now to try to prevent that from happening. Because this industry is so powerful and has so much money, we really need your support, both moral and financial, in order to continue fighting. Thank you.